Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continually go through these things, because I know there's a lot of ambiguity regarding, you know, how people have decided and how people have made these changes in paradigms. To be clear, there was to be no standing armies. They had the power to raise an army, but that raising of the army came from the militia. And so, if necessary, they could have an army and fund it for 2 years at a time. So, as they went through this, how did things get out of the box and out of control? Because, oh, well, these people who did this didn't have much military background. And that's not true. There were plenty of people that did, but their backgrounds and so forth, and back in those days, I would just say that all things weren't equal. The way some of the people in South Carolina compared to some of the people in the northern states, how they functioned as a part of the militia, unless they were in the regular British army like Washington, but that was the regular army. Now, when they see the language, they see the language in the Constitution, and the language in the Constitution states that Congress shall have the power to raise and support armies. Well, how do they raise the army? By mercenary force? Does this mean they can go and bring foreigners in? No. The way they raise the army is to provide for calling forth the militia. In other words, once the militia is in the hands of the federal government, it becomes the federal army. It doesn't become the federal navy. It doesn't become the federal Marine Corps. It becomes the federal army's home defense force. You know, like the Homeland Security, right? Like Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
It is not designed to fight foreign wars. Nowhere in the framers' paradigm did they ever think that this army would ever be put on a ship and go to another foreign nation and die for their cause. That was unthinkable. The army was literally a home defense, and the whole purpose of declaring war was really because we were being invaded. We were being attacked. Now, in today's sense, you don't have to necessarily be invaded. If you're being attacked, let's say people are launching rockets because they're way off in the international shores or international waters, or they're on another, you know, another continent launching missiles because we have that technology today. Does that mean that we don't have a home defense? No, that means we have a strategic defense to ensure that those things are either thwarted or we engage them. That's the job of the, not the Army, folks. That's the job of the Navy.
Right.
So I go through this on and on and on because there's just so many people. The Army has been so big for so long and has been so prevalent in our history that it is completely perverted this concept that America was never to be a police force. We were to be the protectors of commerce, the protectors of interest, and the protectors of life. Not to go around and to make, you know, to bully people and to keep people in check. That was never the intent. But that's what the tyrants love, and that's what the tyrants want, and the tyrants get what they want. Let's just dive into the content because we've got a lot to go through and I want to make sure that we have some time to get through this. Now, we were in the middle of Mr. Nicholas, and I think we were in the middle of the 24 militia segment. I think you were kind of coming to the end, but go ahead and pick it up where you left off.
If the general government be obliged to apply to the states, a part will be thereby rendered superior to the whole. What are to be the effects of the amendments proposed? to destroy one of the most beneficial parts of the Constitution, put an obstacle in the way of the general government, and put it in the power of the state governments to take away the aid of the militia?
Yeah, so let me thank you. Are we to destroy one of the most beneficial parts of the Constitution, put an obstacle in the way of the general government, and put it in the power of the state governments to take away the aid of the militia? In so doing, it forces them now to actually create a army, to basically raise armies and have armies. Now, more importantly, when we really look at, and we're going to get to this, and I've got to do a bunch of scrubbing coming up this week, because I remember reading in the ratification debates, it was the Virginia debates, where they talked about the great mischief of the king and how the king used his standing army to basically enforce his laws. The whole point of the enforcement of laws was never for an army to do it, folks. The militia was to do it. In other words, they would require you to actually federalize so that you would come back to your state or operate within your state to enforce the law. This was the ultimate check. So when he says here, are we going to destroy one of the most beneficial parts of the Constitution, the greatest check that the people have on their government, by taking away the militia? Folks, I know it may be scary to hold, you know, something powerful in your hand like a gun, you know, and be able to send a projectile into somebody that kills them. You have to respect this. You have to respect, you know, the power behind that, as well as the only purposes for doing that. If we as a society, I've said this time and time again, in response to the school shootings and so forth, if we have a society, you know, I'm going to kind of expand this, going sideways a little bit. You know, I'm not a proponent for nudity, but because we have such because America has had these mores that, you know, young kids or people, you know, just get caught up in it. Now, pornography and those types of things are very caught up on, you know, very addictive and hard to overcome. But the reality is that if something isn't so taboo or something isn't so, you know, you know, like making alcohol, you know, for 21 years old. Well, what kids at 13 want to drink? Well, that's because they're children and they're going to try to drink. And the older they get, the easier it is for them to have success in their attempt. Does that make sense? So if they're 18 years old, they're out of their house, then they're actually getting their 21-year-old friends to get them booze. So it's almost stupid to have those types of, those are Puritan laws. And so when we look at this concept of, you know, creating a militia, and we look at how the federal government, in calling forth the militia to create this army, to enforce the laws, are we so bad that, you know, we need somebody, we need angels to basically guard us from ourselves? We have to discipline ourselves. So what really should be happening, when you look at this part of the Constitution where it says the federal government will have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining. In other words, this is a place where we need to have our children learning the respects and the understanding, the safeties, and what this tool is. I mean, how many kids today, as soon as they get a driver's license, start plowing into people? It's a weapon. It can be a weapon, and we can glorify it as a weapon. But the point is that the reason we have problems is because everybody's trying to get rid of them instead of everybody having to use them. The reality is this, that when everybody has a gun, everybody is safe. When nobody has a gun, then the person that has the gun is making, you know, it puts everybody at risk. Puts everybody at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should be looking to basically equalize. It's all about having equality, right? If we all have a handgun, then the likelihood of somebody whipping a gun out is very, very low. These statistics are proven time and time again. And yet, those people who want to have other people control us, it's not about whether, you know, we're capable of controlling ourselves. It is about they wanting to control us. Because they don't like how we think. They don't like the fact that we don't think the way they do. And if they can get enough power, they will make us either think the way they do or they'll get rid of us. That is how evil these folks are. They have no business living in America. If they can't get onto the bandwagon of individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and that we all have a responsibility. So teaching this responsibility to kids is so important. It's the same thing as parenthood. I mean, hopefully every family, every good family has good conversations, wholesome conversations about the importance of preparing and being ready to create a family when you're at that point. Not to be, I mean, the only reason why society is so messed up is because we try not to talk, we try not to have difficult conversations. If you can't have a difficult conversation at home, then why would you think it's better to have it with somebody, you know, I should say that you don't trust, somebody that's in the classroom? Because you have no idea what they're going to say, and it probably won't be anything that you would say. And I'll even go as far as to say this, and then I will crawl slowly and humbly out of this rat hole. Some of the most powerful things in my life has been when I felt the Spirit in my life helping me guide my children and my loved ones, my wife and so forth, in conversations for their benefit. In other words, because of my love and my concern and my prayers, I have been moved to say things I don't even remember where I even thought or said those things, if that makes sense. It's almost like the Spirit just used me to make sure that that person got the message, because I've had those types of effects, you know, and not me. I'm just saying that I've acknowledged from my children that those types of effects have occurred. So why would we think that outside the home, when there's not even that level of love involved, that that type of powerful thing could happen? It could happen if everybody is attuned with the Spirit, but it never happens when they're not. So, and I shouldn't say never, because I know the Lord will, if he wants it to happen, it's going to happen. So, anyway, we need to make sure that our society doesn't have the view that it is taboo to put guns in children's hands, not necessarily putting, you know, ammo in them, live ammo, it could be blanks. At least giving them the ability to understand and, you know, on a one-on-one, so that they know what the power of the weapon is. I remember my grandpa told me how he learned, you know, to shoot, and how he basically, he asked his father, because this was like back in the 30s, he said, can I go hunting for some rabbit so they can have some dinner? And he goes, okay, well, had a can in his hand and walked away and put the can down on the ground. And he basically said, okay, shoot the can. So let me see if you can hit the can. And then Grandpa said, well, the can's, you know, the house, is the can's in between me and the house. If I miss it, I could hit the house. And he goes, as far as I'm concerned, you know how to shoot a weapon. Because he was thinking about, you know, the ramifications of that one particular round. And, I mean, he was a very young man, but I remember him telling me that story, and I'm going, hey, you know, every kid should have that. Every kid should understand that, because when they see their parents having complete respect for life, you know, and, you know, it's not like these people that are going out to kill animals are just bloodthirsty Satanists. They're not. You know, actually, when we look at the Bible says, you know, the world is for us to, you know, to have dominion over. you know, to basically feed us and take care of us. And so, you know, how is it that we pervert these types of things? It's because Satan is driving the perverted bus. And those people that want to get on that bus, they just keep injecting themselves. And this is why we have so many people today, folks, that aren't going to last in America. We're going to have to kick them out. The Tory acts have to become real. We have to actually get rid of people that do not care to respect the liberty of others. There's way too many people in America.
Yeah.
They got rid of 100,000 after the Revolutionary War. They were the Tories that wanted the British government here, and they knew they couldn't trust them. We can't trust these people. You know, OCO or AOC, and all of these evil people in government and all these evil people in education, all of these evil people, we got to get rid of them. And we have to do exactly what the framers did. They don't deserve anything that they have. But we're going to let them keep their life, and we're going to deport them. And we will take their property and basically say, because you've reneged on your dues to our society, we'll let you go start over in somebody else's society. And that's just like that. Bill Gates gone. His riches are gone. It's gone. And now he can start over in China. And he won't have a silver spoon over there waiting for him. So anywho, I apologize for the interruption. But I want to help everybody understand this, that this militia, it is a responsibility of the citizen to support the Constitution. This means that when we do petitions, we're the ones that are lighting the spark. I mean, we're striking the match and putting it onto the wick, or igniting the response that has to happen. If it doesn't come from us, it's not going to happen. And I tell you, folks, you don't want to wait for the Lord to come and do it, because, you know, as we've been seeing the floods, he promised it won't be a flood next time. I mean, there are little floods here and there, but it will be a big fire. So we better start lighting the match here. Anyway, go ahead. I think you were right there. Who will be most likely to want the aid of the militia, right? And it'd be the southern states, like he says here. But go ahead.
Okay. Who will be most likely to want the aid of the militia? The southern states, from their situation. Who are the most likely to be called for? The eastern states, from their strength, etc. Should we put in the power of particular states to refuse the militia? It ought to operate against ourselves. It is the height of bad policy to alter this part of the system, but it is said the militia are to be disarmed. Will they be worse armed than they are now? Still, as my honorable friend said, the states would have power to arm them. The power of arming them is concurrent between the general and state governments. For the power of arming them rested in the state governments before, and although the power be given to the general government, yet it is not given exclusively. For in every instance where the Constitution intends that the general government shall exercise any power exclusively of the state governments, words of exclusion are particularly inserted. Consequently, in every case where such words of exclusion are not inserted, the power is concurrent to the state governments and Congress, unless where it is impossible that the power should be exercised by both. It is therefore not an absurdity to say that Virginia may arm the militia should Congress neglect to arm them, but it would be absurd to say that we should arm them after Congress had armed them, when it would be unnecessary, or that Congress should appoint the officers and train the militia when it is expressly accepted from their power.
Right.
Accepted?
Yeah.
Accepted.
Yes, expressly accepted from their power. So, from their power. So, right. The intent is that if the states have to, then they should equally be able to go back and offset to say, hey, this was your job. Because we had to do this, and you didn't do this, then, you know, we're going to push back on that tax. And there you go. So this is how reconciliation gets done, if that makes sense. Okay, so now he dives into martial law, and he dives into this in more detail, even though Madison, I think, you know, hit it well. I mean, he was very succinct and concise. He gets into a little better detail here. Go ahead.
Okay, but his great uneasiness is that the militia may be under martial law when not on duty. A little attention will be sufficient to remove this apprehension. The Congress is to have power to provide for the arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Another part tells you that they are to provide for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. These powers only amount to this, that they can only call forth in these three cases, and that they can only govern such part of them as may be in the actual service of the United States. This causes a sufficient security that they will not be under martial law, but when in actual service.
And actually, we've even qualified, that when it comes to executing the laws of the Union, they won't necessarily need to be martial law, right? But in response to an insurrection, so when we look at executing the laws of the Union, we don't necessarily mean that you know, there's a whiskey rebellion. A whiskey rebellion is an insurrection, right? There's a difference, right? And as he points out, that there are the three cases for actually having the federal government to having an army. Executing the laws, suppressing insurrections, repelling invasions. Therefore, if they actually do call them forth, will they need to declare martial law to execute the laws? No. But if they have to, in other words, what I'm saying is, if there's an insurrection, then they need to declare martial law. If it's literally simply making sure that people are paying their debts because they're not paying. It's one thing that they're not paying, but, you know, okay, so we need to go and make sure you pay. And so that doesn't mean that they would need, and technically when they have to deploy for the execution of laws, you know, I'd really have to think about what that would be, because, you know, most people, if it's a constitutional law, right? I mean, they don't have any constitutional authority to mandate health, you know, procedures, vaccinations, those types of things. So they can't do those things. They can't execute those types of laws. Mm-hmm. So when you really look at the laws they would be executing, it would probably be the collection of paying taxes, the collection of taxes. They're not to actually collect from the individuals, only in the case of excise taxes from the retailers and or from the producers. Typically, the way they did it is they charged the producer up front, upstream. That's where the tax would be paid, because it would be the most efficient, reducing the administrative cost, so that it would save the tax, whoever has to pay that tax, you know, a little more money, because the more administration, the more of the bureaucracy at every stage of the game that they're adding to this, it adds a cost of the taxation, the administrative cost. So that way, when we kind of look at, you know, how the taxes are being paid and how the execution of the law would be done, I just have a hard time thinking that there would ever be a point where they would need martial law in executing those laws. It would only be when it becomes a full-out rebellion and insurrection against paying those taxes. Why would the people, you know, revolt? Well, why did we revolt? We didn't want to pay taxes without representation, right? Same thing. Okay, so, you know, he's pointing out here the whole point of why they, you know, would actually, you know, be under martial law, and I totally believe, and we're going into a break right here, I totally believe that the martial law would literally only be necessary when there's the use of deadly force because of an insurrection and or an invasion. And that's exactly what ended up happening with the Whiskey Rebellion. What should be happening today? I don't know. The gathering of illegals in the United States shouldn't necessarily be in that particular case. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we move forward through here, he's going to get into the details, but and help break things out regarding martial law. Now, there was nothing in any of the other debates that I found where they actually got into this type of detail. So how important is this? What do you think, Tammy? How important is it that they actually had this conversation? Maybe that somebody knew that in these days they would try to declare martial law, like in the Civil War, mm-hmm. that they would try to declare martial law. The fact that they actually captured the details of how martial law could be utilized in the United States government, to me, this is profound. Because that means that these are the hardcore constraints on what our government can actually do. But if they get away with pretending the law, then they will get away with actually declaring this type of tyranny of martial law, suspending habeas corpus and the writ of habeas corpus and so forth. So anyway, go ahead.
Okay. If, sir, a mutiny bill has continued since the revolution, recollect that this is done under the present happy government. Under the new government, no appropriation of money to the use of raising or supporting an army shall be for a longer term than 2 years. The president is to command, but the regulation of the army and navy is given to Congress. Our representatives will be a powerful check here. The influence of the commons in England, in this case, is very predominant. But the worthy member of the other side of the House has said that the militia are the great bulwark of the nation and wishes to take no step to bring them into disuse. What is the inference? He wishes to see the militia employed. The Constitution provides what he wants. This is to bring them frequently into use. If he expects that, by depriving the general government of the power of calling them into more frequent use, they will be rendered more useful and expert, he is greatly deceived. We ought to part with the power to use the militia to somebody. To whom? Ought we not to part with it for the general defense? If you give it not to Congress, it may be denied by the states. If you withhold it, you render a standing army absolutely necessary. For if they have not the militia, they must have such a body of troops as will be necessary for the general defense of the Union.
Okay, so if they don't allow the militia to come forward, then the states are violating the Constitution. In other words, the Constitution has to be amended for the states to not allow the militia to be used anymore, and that they're going to have their own little standing armies. If we really understand, or I should say, the militia itself is going to be a system throughout the United States. In other words, when we really look at how the states should have employed the militia, they should have done the same thing. And it should have been done by the counties, actually, that the counties would maintain an appropriate force of militia for their own needs, and that every county would basically be a part of the state's militia. but they would be autonomous unless the state needed to deploy them. In other words, doing the exact same thing in a state constitution. And so if the state needed to execute the laws, if the state needed to suppress an insurrection, and or if they needed to repel an invasion, because it could be a border state, then the state would and the governor would have the authority based on the legislature and the constitution that the legislature would call them forward. If we followed the same paradigm that we, the people, technically down at the county level now, we have the militia there. The militia is to execute the laws. If we allow a city, if we allow a municipality to create a mercenary force to execute their own laws, then we've stepped away from the system. And that's where the rub really came in, because we needed to maintain, and we should have embraced this, and this means that the county should have had constitutions where they would actually keep the state militia from being formed into a state police or what have you. That the surely the state needed to have the ability to protect the people, to do those same things that the federal government would have to do. This is where, when we start applying, you know, when we take the U.S. Constitution and start drilling it down to the states, to the counties, this is how we actually preserve liberty and we actually promote self-governance. But when we actually...
Yes, every county should have their own little militia.
Absolutely. And they even say this here. I think we've already covered it, where they talked about every county would have their own militia. If not, it's coming up. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. It was said by the gentleman that there was something singular in this government in saying that the militia shall be called forth to execute the laws of the Union. There is a great difference between having the power in three cases and in all cases. They cannot call them forth for any other purpose than to execute the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
So you see, they're having to repeat this over and over just like I am. That these are the only ways they can actually get engaged in using deadly force by this army. Go ahead.
And can anything be more demonstrably obvious than that the laws ought to be enforced if resisted and insurrections quelled and foreign invasions repelled? But it is asked, why has not the Constitution declared that the civil power shall be employed to execute the laws? Has it said that the civil power shall not be employed? The civil officer is to execute the laws on all occasions, and if he be resisted, this auxiliary power is given to Congress of calling forth the militia to execute them, when it shall be found absolutely necessary.
Go ahead, keep going.
On this occasion, and his eulogium in the executive magistrate of Britain, it might be interfered that the executive magistrate here was to have the power of calling forth the militia. What is the idea of those gentlemen who heard his argument on this occasion? Is it not that the president is to have this power? That president who tells us is not to have those high feelings and that fine sensibility which the British monarch possesses? No, sir, the president is not to have this power. God forbid we should ever see a public man in this country who should have this power. Congress only are to have the power of calling forth the militia. And will the worthy member say that he would trust this power to a prince governed by the dictates of ambition or mere motives of personal interest sooner than he would trust it in the hands of Congress? I will trust Congress because they will be actuated by motives of fellow feeling. They can make no regulations but what will affect themselves, their friends, and relations. But I would not trust a prince whose ambition and private views would be the guide of his actions. When the government is carried on by representatives and persons of my own choice, whom I can follow when far removed, who can be displaced at stated in short periods, I can safely confide the power to them. It appears to me that this power is essentially necessary, for as the general defense is trusted to Congress, we ought to entrust fully the means. This cannot be fully done without giving the power of calling forth the militia, and this power is sufficiently guarded.
All right, so now we're going to go down. And actually, if you notice, we're going to skip over Madison. And Madison kind of has this, you know, decent little oration, and then Henry. And actually, if you look at the very end, and you'll find in the ratification debates, there's a lot of things that Madison said that did not get caught. Because it said, Mr. Madison made other observations, but spoke so very low that he could not be distinctively heard. So in other words, those words didn't get included. It's almost like, you know, sometimes people have, you know, you hear in the scriptures that those there are certain things that were not put in. Anyway, I kind of wonder if sometimes when Madison made some utterances and so forth, maybe it was really more for the edification of the few people close to him and not necessarily for all of us. But anyway, and I don't think it was something that was done deliberately. I just think that those were the circumstances that occurred. So Mr. Henry goes off and he talks on, and then again Mr. Madison comes back and speaks some more. And then Governor Randolph, you know, speaks, and then George Mason wants to promote himself some more, and Governor Randolph then, and then Mason, and now Mr. Lee of Westmoreland, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So now we have this little short note. Go ahead.
Okay. But says he, the creature destroys the creator. How has he proved it? By his bare assertion, by ascribing infinitude to powers clearly limited and defined for certain designated purposes. I shall not repeat the arguments which have fully refuted this idea of the honorable gentleman.
Okay, so when we look at what he just basically said, he's looking to Mason and Henry, because these are the two guys, the anti-federalists, that were trying to, you know, twist the paradigm so that everybody would see it. And in other words, what they were uttering here, like he says, but he says, or says he, the creature destroys the creator. That can't happen unless the creator allows it and empowers it. Okay. And so it's almost like the universe requires positive and negative. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. The good and evil. Let's just, you know, positive being good, evil being bad. Good and, or good, positive, evil, you know, negative. And so when we look at the electrical forces of positive and negative, it is essential for a balance. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that evil is necessary? Let me ask you this. This goes down a paradigm that I, you know, has been basically pounded into my head by people that basically says, how can you appreciate the good things in life if you've never tasted the bitter things in life?
Yeah.
Now, who wants to taste...
I don't know if I would say evil is necessary. I would say free will is necessary.
Free will is absolutely necessary, but good and evil, the balance of that, not that we have to have a balance, but the balance of nature depends upon it. Because what happens if we have too much positive? What happens if we have too much negative? The nature goes out of whack. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the poles, the magnetic poles of the Earth. They get out of whack, and they correct themselves. And there, you know, there's actually been, you know, studies of, you know, when those corrections have occurred. Sometimes they're just a gradual, but sometimes it's a pretty abrupt correction. And usually it's a very tumultuous point, a tumultuous time. And it's interesting. Did you know how they could tell the direction of the poles? Now, I learned this in natural science, that the shield volcanoes on the ocean floor, when the magma comes up and before it cools, because it has this electrical magnetic pole nature to itself, while it is still molten, the alignment aligns with the magnetic poles. So they, as they examined the lava fields from these large shield flows, they could actually tell how the poles had shifted, because the direction of the alignment of these elements or what have you were very obvious. They would go this way, and then they would point differently. Over, you know, they would gradually change over time or abruptly change. And so, you know, it's through the detailed observation of history how things function today. And it's the way you can watch what happens in history to predict what's going to happen tomorrow. So I see this as, you know, we have these things in life that are positives and negatives. Now there's good and evil. Do we need to have the devil? I don't think we need to have the devil. The devil doesn't need to be in heaven. But in a learning environment, I mean, you can have environments that are sterile, right? But in a learning environment, you want to have, you know, these natural forces be able to, you know, help people gain a greater understanding of the ramifications.
Right, which would be free will.
Well, yeah. So, well, but
the free will to choose.
Yeah, but
evil.
So I'm just saying that over time, wisdom helps us acquire, you know, how those choices have affected us in our lives. But free will is, you know, I think it's paramount. I honestly think that free will is a part of nature itself. Because when you have that sterile environment, that is not a natural environment. So I look at ideologically, you know, that in the great sphere of our creation through, you know, the spirit world and so forth, and I don't mean to get spiritual, but we're there. So I look at that as, even though we couldn't make choices, we still had the freedom to gravitate towards what we thought would work best. Even though we couldn't see, we didn't have empirical data and couldn't prove things, because if you look at the war in heaven, people took sides.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, even there was a level of free will. So I believe it is a part of the natural state of what we call, you know, because what is a person? Is a person a physical thing, or is a person a spiritual thing, or is it both? And I have to say it's both. But in heaven, we didn't have the physical thing, but we still had that free will. So anyway.
Absolutely.
So let's keep going, because this is where he talks about interposition, militia, and the sheriff. Go ahead.
Okay. But gentlemen say that we must apply to the militia to execute the constitutional laws without the interposition of the civil power, and that a military officer is to be substituted for the sheriff in all cases. This unwarrantable objection is urged, like many others, to produce the rejection of this government though contrary to reason. What is the meaning of the clause under debate? Does not their explanation violate the natural meaning of language? Is it to be inferred that when the laws are not opposed, judgments must be executed by the militia? Is this the right and liberal way of discussing the general national objects? I am astonished that the gentleman should attempt to impose so absurd a construction upon us.
Keep going.
You want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going, yeah.
Okay, the honorable gentleman last up says that organizing the militia gives Congress power to punish them when not in the actual service of the government. The gentleman is mistaken in the meaning of the word organization, to explain which would unnecessarily take up time. Suffice it to say, it does not include the infliction of punishments. The militia will be subject to the common regulations of war when in actual service, but not in time of peace. But the honorable gentleman said there is a danger of an abuse of power and attempted to exemplify. And delegated power may be abused. It would be civil and candid in those gentlemen who inveigh against the Constitution with such malignity to show in what manner adequate powers can be given without a possibility of being abased. It appears to me to be as well secured as it can be, and that the alterations he proposes would involve many disadvantages. It cannot, then, but conclude that this government will, in my opinion, secure our liberty and happiness without any alteration.
Okay, so I find it interesting that he, you know, kind of points out the how the anti-federalist, he says, the gentleman is mistaken in the meaning of the word organization, because what he said is, the honorable gentleman last up says that organizing the militia gives Congress power to punish them. No, it doesn't. All it does is it basically lays out how they're to be organized. In other words, you know, the platoons, the platoon elements, those types of how they're going to be functioning. This only guarantees uniformity, because by allowing these types of guidelines to be centralized, or at least be centrally controlled, because if you leave it to the states are going to do what they want to do. And the federal government wants to be able to put all of the militia together so that they don't need to call the entire militia away from home. They only need to take a small patch from a few of the different states and deploy them down to where they need to go. And that they all function the same. Their platoon size, elements, and those types of things are all uniform. Because if they're not, then who, you know, how are you guys doing that? I mean, it is important for basically having a well-disciplined force to be able to do those things. So Mr. Clay speaks, and then Mr. Madison kind of speaks. And I let me look at this. Is Mr. Madison's point really? No. Okay, so Mr. Clay makes a comment. And this is where we start talking about riots and insurrections. So it looks like it's a Mr. Madison comment. I'm going to change that. And I'm going to put that underneath. So now we can see that that's a Mr. Clay question, because it's an anti-federalist opposition to the laws. So go ahead, let's read this little banter back and forth that we can kind of dive into. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Clay wished to know the instances where an opposition to the laws did not come within the idea of an insurrection. Mr. Madison replied that a riot did not come within the legal definition of an insurrection. There might be riots to oppose the execution of the laws, which the civil power might not be sufficient to quell. This was one case, and there might probably be other cases. He referred to the candor of the committee, whether the militia could ever be used to destroy themselves.
Okay, so in other words, could the county deploy the militia in a point of a riot to basically say, you know, people are doing flash mob or whatever? And the question is, would these people, because, you know, you're looking at these kids, hey, that's Bob's son. I know that guy. I mean, are you going to be more likely to hurt and harm them and kill them than a mercenary force that's come in from Germany to basically say, we got to put these guys down? I mean, they will not even bat an eye, and we see this all the time. If you really don't know who that person is that you're inflicting harm, if it's really a stranger, the Milgram experiments have even proven this. I mean, I'll bet you anything, if it was a husband and a wife, if it was a husband, are you familiar with the Milgram experiment?
No.
You need to watch the video. It was this experiment that the CIA did. They brought strangers together, and they put a stranger, you know, in a room with the conductor, and the conductor would be asking questions. And if the person couldn't properly answer the question, the operator that was there in the room with them, the stranger, would basically dial up on this magneto-electrical machine and send a charge to that person. And they don't see this person. They have no idea. And that person, you know, and then eventually, you know, they just kind of pass out. It builds to a point where the person says, "You're going to kill me. You're going to kill me." And it really inflicts this fear on this person. And an astronomically high percentage of these strangers continue to hurt these people they don't know. I guarantee you, if that's a husband and a wife, if that's a neighbor, you know, if their neighbors hate each other, then, oh, yeah, I'm sure. But if they don't have ill will and they know that person, there's no way they would inflict that pain. I'm sorry, this is stupid. Why am I doing this? They would challenge it. Do you see my point?
Yeah.
But it is highly more probable and actually more successful when you ask, you know, strangers to harm people. It'll happen. Okay, so now we kind of move down into June 15th, and Mr. Henry makes a comment regarding common law. Go ahead.
Okay, the honorable gentleman said that the militia should be called forth to quell riots. Have we not seen this business go on very well today without military force? It is a long-established principle of the common law of England that civil force is sufficient to quell riots.
Okay. Now, Madison ends up responding. Go ahead.
Madison.
Right.
Under sheriff?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay. An act passed a few years ago in this state to enable the governments to call forth the militia to enforce the laws when a powerful combination should take place to oppose them. This is the same power which the Constitution is to have. There is a great deal of difference between calling forth the militia when a combination is formed to prevent the execution of the laws and the sheriff or constable carrying with him a body of militia to execute them in the first instance, which is a construction not warranted by the clause. There is an act also in this state empowering the officers of the customs to summon any person to assist them when they meet with obstruction in executing their duty. This shows the necessity of giving the government power to call forth the militia when the laws are resisted. It is a power vested in every legislature in the Union and which is necessary to every government. He then moved that the clerk should read those acts which were accordingly read.
Okay, so Madison's making a point that if the circumstances require where the sheriff needs somebody to aid them, they have the power and authority to call upon a person to aid them. Period. And the only way that person will aid them, one, is if they're educated on that and they know that this is a legitimate requirement being levied upon them, and that if they don't comply, that they could equally be arrested. Because you want to teach people that, because the last thing you want to do is be confronted with the situation and then be called upon, and then because you think, well, I don't have to do this, and what ends up happening is you end up basically getting in, put in handcuffs and taken to jail because you've refused to do your duty when called upon as a citizen. I can't emphasize this enough. We'll bring this back up again in our next content episode so that we can actually dive into this with Tammy, because unfortunately, I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.